Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. The most popular word in Washington this week? Here's a hint. It's a transitive verb. It's all I'm going to give you from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 9th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Some vocabulary to begin this week of congressional hearings into nominees for President-elect Trump's cabinet. Vet. It's a verb. To vet. To, according to Merriam-Webster, evaluate for possible approval or acceptance, as in vet the candidates for a position. This is going to be a slammed week in political America. President Obama's farewell address tomorrow. President-elect Trump has promised to hold his first press conference since July on Wednesday, and eight confirmation hearings in the Senate of the United States. And that returns us to the word of the day. Remember, to vet. Something the Office of Government Ethics says it has not yet been able to do. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
The Office of Government Ethics raised the alarm last week in a letter to Senate Democrats, saying it was still missing important financial disclosure forms from some of Trump's cabinet nominees and hadn't had time to complete its review of others. So what's in these forms anyway?
Well, it's a list of your assets and income, so the more you've got, the longer it's going to take.
Richard Painter is a law professor at the University of Minnesota. He was the chief White House ethics lawyer for George W. Bush and had to fill out similar disclosure forms.
I was able to do it in an afternoon. Someone like Hank Paulson, who came to the Treasury Department from being the chairman of Goldman Sachs, it took a team of lawyers about 2 weeks to do it for him.
By the way, the cost to prepare those documents is on the nominee, and there are quite a few people with very large and complicated financial holdings lined up for Trump's cabinet. Usually, the ethics office works with nominees on a plan to either sell off holdings or recuse themselves if the need arises. Larry Noble is general counsel at the Campaign Legal Center. He says confirmed cabinet officials could be fined or criminally prosecuted if a conflict comes up later.
Beyond that, conflicts of interest could lead to challenges to all sorts of government decisions. If they involve themselves in government decisions where there's a conflict, that decision could be subject to a lawsuit. People affected by that decision could challenge it.
Republican leaders in the Senate say they'll give careful consideration to each of the nominees, and the Trump campaign has said the vetting process is going just fine. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We're going to talk in a couple of minutes about Twitter and the prospects for that company in the Trump era. First, though, how the president-elect's tweets are changing corporate behavior in this country. Fiat Chrysler has confirmed it's going to invest $1 billion in improving two factories here. 2,000 jobs will come along with that investment. An investment, it must be noted for the record, that Fiat Chairman Sergio Marchionne said this morning has, quote, been in the works for a long period of time. Nonetheless, in a couple of tweets today, Mr. Trump claimed credit for those jobs and for the investment itself, echoing his treatment of decisions by Ford and General Motors. Marketplace's Jed Kim has more now on car companies and the bully Twitter account.
Pretty much every automotive analyst, journalist, or other expert is in Detroit for the auto show, checking out the new hotness. That's where I reached Kristen Gicek with the Center for Automotive Research. Fortunately, she has a cell phone and a knack for finding a quiet spot to chat.
I'm sitting in a very boring car that nobody else wants to sit in, so I won't get bothered.
Gicek says Fiat Chrysler's announcement has less to do with fears over what the Trump administration will do, more to do with long-term strategy.
An auto plant lasts about 40 to 50 years, not four. So anything that they're doing is based on what they think the market is at and where their business case is.
Still, there's no denying that being singled out by a Trump tweet is troubling, says Jeff Schuster with LMC Automotive.
I think we're seeing the announcements as a way to maybe head off further trouble down the road.
Trouble in the form of possible import tariffs.
The industry is looking at it as a way to essentially give Donald Trump what he wants, but also allow them to continue their overall strategy as a global automaker.
Schuster says it's still not clear what Trump's policies will be and how they'll affect carmakers' operating decisions. There could be an indirect clue, though.
The show here is about SUVs.
Low oil prices have made Americans more likely to buy larger vehicles. With Trump signaling he may roll back environmental regulations like gas mileage, automakers may keep churning them out. From American factories, of course. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
All right, enough of the politics of the American economy. How about some economics of the American economy? All right, the limited has reached the end of the road, the brick and mortar road, that is. The once popular women's clothing chain and familiar mall tenant is on its way out. The online presence stays for now, but the company confirmed today it is closing all 250 of its stores in the U.S. and cutting 4,000 jobs. That, as other big retailers, Macy's and Sears, to name just two, are struggling as well. Marketplace's Sally Herships has more on the increasingly familiar cycle of retail boom and bust.
Have you worn yoga pants recently anywhere besides to yoga? If so, you may be on trend, one called athleisure. Wendy Liebman is CEO of WSL Strategic Retail, a consulting firm.
Of, you know, wear yoga pants every day, whether you should or you shouldn't.
Fun fact, I am right now wearing jogging pants and a sweatshirt.
Well, there you go.
Liebman says times have changed since she was young.
And I remember looking at the ads for Saks Fifth Avenue, and they were black and white and very elegant, and it would say very Saks Fifth Avenue.
But now you don't need to go to a department store to get a hoodie. Instead, there's H&M or Zara. Liebman says fast fashion chains like those are hard for older chains like The Limited to keep up with. And there's another problem. Hart Posen teaches management at the University of Wisconsin. He says just look at a shirt or sweater on The Limited's website.
And ask, you know, which store is this from? I think most people, including their customers, would be hard-pressed to say this is an item from The Limited.
Posen says that also means a problem for Macy's and Aeropostale and other familiar brands. America just has too much brick-and-mortar retail space. Paul Swinand is a retail industry analyst with Four Hills Advisors.
Since 1970, retail square footage grew at about a 12% annual clip.
Faster than the general population. But more recently, consumers have been shopping more online and spending less on apparel. After all, most hoodies and yoga pants cost a lot less than the designer options at Saks. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Tell you what, you go away for a couple of weeks, some vacation, some reporting time in Erie, PA, and Dow 20,000 gets farther away. Go figure that one out. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Believe me when I tell you that every time I start setting up a story by talking about what Donald Trump has tweeted, I second guess myself because it seems odd to be reporting on industrial and economic policy being made at 6 in the morning, 140 characters at a time. But the president-elect is the president-elect, and what he tweets is usually, not always, but usually news. Thing is, though, the Trumpian tweets don't seem to be doing Twitter, the company, any good. Nick Bilton has been thinking about all this. He's a special correspondent for Vanity Fair. His most recent piece is called After Trump, Will Twitter Wither? Nick, thanks for coming into the studio.
Thanks for having me in.
Here we have a company that is the primary means of communication for the president-elect of the United States, and it is still somehow in trouble.
I've been covering all these companies for a long time, and I have never seen a company, whether a for-profit, non-profit, anything, that has so much trouble financially, new users, all these different things, but yet is so utterly relevant to society.
Relevant ain't revenue, though.
No,
I mean,
it's not.
That's the point.
And one of the things that, you know, that's been really interesting is when you look at some of the reports from JP Morgan and analysts and so on, they assumed that, okay, that there would be a Trump effect, that Trump using Twitter would incite people to join. But let's look at the numbers. 62 million people voted for Trump.
Yep.
And Trump has 18 million followers on Twitter, 19 million today, actually, just crossed.
So he's not maximizing the potential use either, right?
Exactly. And, you know, right. And also part of a lot of those followers are bots. they're not real people. And so people are not joining Twitter just to see what Trump has to say.
You make a very interesting point in this piece that Kim Kardashian gets more interactions with her tweets than Donald Trump ever does.
Completely. I mean, an average Donald Trump tweet, even with those bots, he's still getting a tiny fraction of what some of these bigger celebrities are getting. A tweet from one of the guys from One Direction has 2.3 million retweets and likes, and Trump's getting 20, 30, 40,000 maybe.
Let me get you to the business side of this operation. Jack Dorsey, with whom you've spoken many times, we've had him on this program, is the CEO of the company. He faces a 2017 that's going to be very interesting, right? He's got a whole bunch of executives he's got to replace. He's got that average users thing he's got to fix.
You know, I do
stock price and all that.
I do not want to. I would not want to be in Jack's shoes right now. I think, you know, he's running two companies still. Square, which is the company, is actually doing pretty well. The stock's on the rise. Twitter stock is not doing well, and it hasn't. It's fallen from, you know, highs in the 60s after it went public. At 30s when Jack joined, it's now in the teens, and there's a lot of analysts that say it's going to go south even further. You know, they've tried to sell the company to no avail. A lot of people don't want to buy a service that ISIS uses, and I don't know how he's going to fix the massive, massive exodus of really talented people that have left the company over the last 6 months.
How big a challenge do you think the idea of not just ISIS, but the alt-right, that is white nationalists and white supremacists, and horrible, vile abuse is to the continuing business fortunes of this company?
I think that one of the things I've learned covering companies is that companies become the DNA of their founders. You know, Facebook is an incredibly tight and sophisticated institution that has grown because Mark Zuckerberg wants to be king. With Twitter, from day one, it was chaos. And that is what the actual platform is. Sure, it's a little box that you can type 140 characters into, but you can do a lot of damage with 140 characters, as you can see from Donald Trump. If Jack Dorsey wanted to fix the problems that the service has created, it would mean that they're not going to grow the user base. They're probably going to see it detract. And that goes against the idea that investors want to see the company grow.
So in a year, plus or minus, where is Twitter, do you think?
In a year, plus or minus, that's a great question. I think that in a year, the stock will be in the single digits. I really do. I don't care who's running it. If you're Jack Dorsey, Steve Jobs, Donald Trump, whatever, it is not a very easy company to fix. And we've seen this. They've gone through, you know, most Fortune 500 companies have a CEO's tenure of 10 years. They've had five CEOs in 10 years.
Nick Belton writes for Vanity Fair. Remind me what the name of your book on Twitter was.
It was called Hatching Twitter.
Hatching Twitter. We did the interview actually on this program, embarrassingly enough. It's on our website, marketplace.org. Writes for Vanity Fair now. His piece is called After Trump, Will Twitter Wither? Nick, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a couple of minutes now for a series that we call My Economy, stories from listeners making a go of it in the economic day-to-day. Healthcare is on the minds of a lot of Americans right now, in Congress and out. So our dispatch today comes from just outside Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
My name is Margaret Enos, and I'd say that the economy feels really iffy. In 1994, we had a baby daughter. We found out when she was about 6 months old that she'd had a stroke, so that caused her to have cerebral palsy. We were two teachers working at a boarding school, living in the dorm and supervising kids in exchange for housing. I mean, the great thing and the hard thing about boarding school is you have to really love high school kids and live with them 24/7, you know. And so we went from two people doing that to one person doing that. My full-time job got to be taking care of Megan, and you're giving up a job to do something that you're not getting paid for, but there's no alternative. In our case, there was a parents group, there was a social worker, there were people to explain stuff along the way when the kid was young. The thing that would make it easiest now is similar help going into the adult world, because now she's 22. People with disability are underemployed, but it's also true there are people with a disability who can't even be employed. And I'd hate to think that we're the kind of society that would think that those people don't deserve to have a quality of life.
Margaret, Enos, we got her outside Philadelphia, as I said. Do us a favor and write in with the story of your economy. There's a place you can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
We couldn't run our business without migrant workers. You know, they're loyal, they're hardworking.
Brexit and the British labor force. Straight ahead. But first, sure, yeah, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off a third of 1% today, about 76 points, 19,887 on the blue chips. The S&P 500 down 0.3%, 8 points, 2268. S&P 500, as I said, 0.3%. The NASDAQ picked up 0.2%, 10 points, finished at 55.31. Tech told the big story as the iPhone celebrated its 10th birthday. Perhaps you've heard Apple shares up 0.9% for the day, but 800%. Since that phone was introduced, Facebook, been on a tear of its own lately, clicked up 1 2/10% today. Told you about Fiat Chrysler's big announcement. Shares in the automaker, which is going to be building more SUVs and pickups, drove up 1.4% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.36%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This was not the cheeriest of Mondays for the British pound. Sterling fell sharply against the dollar today after Prime Minister Theresa May appeared to imply in an interview Sunday that there is going to be what's called a hard Brexit from the European Union. Out means out. In other words, no special access to the oh-so-lucrative European market. May tried to walk that back today, but the foreign exchange damage was done. And even though it's still going to be at least 2 years before anything happens, Brexit and the threat thereof is already having big economic repercussions. Even, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from Yorkshire, up in the north of England, even how British farms are operating.
Poskett Carrots prides itself on its fresh local produce from a big family farm in Yorkshire. Many of the staff, though, are not homegrown.
Hello, Poskett.
Answering the phone and greeting visitors, receptionist Aista Lukashuta.
I'm from Lithuania and working here for about 8 years.
Most of her fellow workers are EU migrants too, from Latvia, Estonia and Poland, and they've been vital to the success of Poskett Carrots, says the boss, Guy Poskett.
Migrant workers are a real key part of our business. You know, we've got some good local workers, just not enough of them. We couldn't run our business without migrant workers. You know, they're loyal, they're hardworking. Why have we got Lithuanian receptionists? Because we struggle to find a local receptionist who would start at 7:30 in the morning.
But it's getting harder to attract good EU migrants. The supply of willing workers from Eastern Europe to staff the production line and run the office has dwindled since Britain voted for Brexit last June.
Well, I think the Brexit vote is a signal. You know, Britain doesn't want the migrants. But, of course, you've got to remember also, they've taken a 10 or 15% cut in pay.
As a result of the fall in the value of the pound.
If you're earning to send your money home back in euros, you have taken a 10 to 15% pay cut.
That's a bit of a deterrent.
Yeah, it's a huge deterrent.
To combat the labour shortages, Poskett has resorted to technology. He's just spent $2.8 million on this automatic carrot grading machine.
So you can see it's taking a picture of that carrot, yeah? And it's decided how wide it is, what it weighs, what its length, and then it's decided where to put it depending on its defect level.
The machine sorts 20,000 carrots an hour, doing the work of 22 people. Brexit should end the automatic right of EU citizens to work in the UK. Poskett's labour shortage would worsen. He's now looking to automate more of the business.
Now has come a time where we really have got to look further at automation in terms of replacing labour. It's just how it is, because we're very concerned that we won't have the people to do the work.
That's great news for this company. Garfords makes farm automation equipment, including RoboCrop, an automatic weeding machine.
We use video cameras to analyse the crop ahead of the hoeing machine.
Philip Garford says his device will replace 30 farm labourers. Since the Brexit vote, he says he's seen a big rise in inquiries from British farms.
Farmers are indicating that they are thinking ahead and thinking about the potential loss of migrant workers.
More than 190,000 EU migrants arrive in Britain every year. If many stay away after Brexit and many more companies are forced to automate, that could be beneficial. It would raise the country's output per head and tackle the perennial British problem of low productivity. Matthew Whittaker is with the Resolution Foundation, a think tank.
From a purely economic perspective, if we can boost productivity, then the Brexit vote will have actually had some positive impact.
But unlike Poskett's and many other farm enterprises, some businesses that are heavily dependent on migrant labour will find it much tougher to automate. Think domestic services and the hotel trade. For them, Brexit may prove more stick than carrot. In Yorkshire, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Public health officials say this country's opioid epidemic is the worst drug crisis this country has ever seen. Tens of thousands of people are dying every year. Costs are going up across the healthcare system, and there has been a spike in the number of drug-dependent babies being born. Those babies spend their first days getting expensive treatments to help them withdraw from the painkillers or the heroin that their mothers were hooked on, which is why one healthcare startup sees some profit potential in helping to curb the cost of caring for those infants. From WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer has the story.
In some parts of the country, neonatal intensive care units continue to fill with babies who cry and tremble as they come down off the drugs their mothers were on. Tiffany Hall is from a rural area in northeast Tennessee at the epicenter of the state's opioid problem, and she knows about the epidemic firsthand. She's been on both sides of the glass, first as a nurse.
I worked with the babies born into addiction. I knew what could happen.
But Hall says that while she was a nurse, she was addicted to opioids, pills. She was out of control and just chasing the next high. She lost her job as a nurse and soon became a mother to twins.
So then, after losing my job in the NICU, I end up having two babies in the NICU with neonatal abstinence syndrome.
Neonatal abstinence syndrome, or NAS, is the term to describe a baby born dependent on opioids. It usually means infants need to stay in the hospital for weeks as they're closely monitored and weaned off the narcotics by taking tiny doses of methadone. Hall says they're enduring withdrawals, just like an adult would.
You stand there and you watch your own child go through something you're not willing or wanting to go through yourself.
Hall says it's an awful thing to see. It's also expensive, says entrepreneur Justin Lanning.
A baby born with NAS, on average, in the nation costs about $66,000 in the first 4 months of life. A baby born without NAS in the first 4 months of life costs about $3,300. So there's your savings.
The tens of thousands of dollars are seen as an avoidable expense to insurance companies, especially the government-subsidized programs that end up covering so many of the NAS babies. Lanning is the founder of the for-profit 180 Health Partners. He says if it can keep a newborn out of the NICU, it gets a cut of the savings. To do this, the company is thinking beyond traditional medical care to help mothers step down off pain pills or heroin. It could mean guiding a mother-to-be through detox center wait lists, finding her reliable transportation to get to group therapy, or just securing a stable place to live. The company has signed contracts with insurance companies to basically do whatever it takes. Lanning says he's trying a new approach to the workforce.
About 60 to 70% of our staff are mothers who have previously dealt with addiction.
I believe it can be said that we went to the school of life to get trained for this job.
Melanie McCarter of Knoxville, Tennessee, had a stillborn child while she was abusing opioids. She's been sober for 4 years and was hired as one of the company's first peer mentors. They work for a little less money than a licensed social worker. She sees the role as that of a sister or a coach.
You know, the tough love, somebody who can tell you how it really is and what's really going on and not love you to death, not enable you, you know, because that was what was happening to me. I had a lot of people in my life who loved me but just didn't know what to do for me.
Besides its unconventional hires, this startup also has some industry heavyweights on its board, including heart surgeon and former U.S. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. NAS experts are keeping an eye on the company. Neonatologist Stephen Patrick of Vanderbilt Medical Center says his primary concern is that there may be too much focus on detox.
I think the literature suggests that we should be cautious about tapering off in pregnancy because of high relapse rates. So it's something I think we should be watchful.
But Patrick says the startup's mere existence confirms that pregnant women struggling with an opioid addiction need more attention than they're currently getting. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today. Remember back in the fall amid all the political hullabaloo how television ratings for NFL games were down something like 15% and everybody said, it's just the election. The NFL's fine. That gets us to this and the 10 or more billion dollar a year institution that is the National Football League. Ratings for this weekend's wildcard games were down 7% from the same weekend a year ago. Could be because they were all blowouts, but hey, you tell me. Also, I'm thinking Clemson tonight in an upset. Well, that was weird. Wasn't here when I went away. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 31%, 76 points. The NASDAQ up 0.2%, 10 points. S&P 500 down 0.3%, about 8 points. Production team is Bridget Bonder, Robert Garova, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.